Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Real World Entrepreneurship Podcast. My name is Alan Clark.
And I'm Byron Patel.
And in today's episode, we're going to share with you 10 things that we think every business startup needs to know before they launch their business. This is based on both of us having started up, launched and run businesses, but also on a whole range of experience working with a whole raft of different companies. So, Mara, first up from you, why is it important to get the right legals in place?
So this is something that I learned, I guess, many years ago, right? And I've learned this not only through experience, but also anecdotally, right? So when we say, or when I say, get the right legals in place, what I'm talking about is understand the structure of your business and the relationship you're going to have with your co-founders or anyone else that you bring on board to help you with the business. So I've heard so many horror stories. I mean, one story I heard a couple of years back was where a company had a very, very promising business. They'd raised a lot of money after a couple of years of functioning, but they still had a CTO who had something around about 25% of the business and could still make decisions. And basically was on the board as well, and they couldn't get rid of him. And so, you know, these guys had raised, he'd only stayed for the company for about 6 months. And after he'd left, like 2 years after he'd left, they'd raised two, 3 million, and they were still beholden to him. And he was really getting a lot of the upside and having zero, you know, zero, having put zero in. And they were, he was blocking decisions and making their lives very difficult. And to me, I said to them, well, didn't you think about what would happen if something goes wrong and you fall out? And they were like, no. And this is one of these things that you see quite repeatedly. Obviously, when people are starting businesses, everyone's friendly. And I think that even if things are going well, you still need to ensure what will happen if things go horribly wrong, but also what can go, you know, what can go wrong if things go very, very well. So people get greedy. The more money that you have, people get greedier, right? And if one person starts taking out twice as much as the other person starts taking out, you know, is that really fair? Is that something that you want happening? Can you live with that over the long term? So I think this is not necessarily just about having the right documents incorporated and making sure that you've got, you know, the right articles of association and things like that. It's really about regulating the relationship that you have with everyone else that you want to be involved
with. You mean going further than a shareholders agreement?
So, but having a good shareholders agreement, so having a shareholders agreement that takes these contingencies into play. So when I've started, let's say, for example, we started Avrium, now there were six of us who were initially shareholders of that. And what we decided was that, okay, even though it's a business with zero value because we're just starting out, we need to make sure that if things do take off, that we are all certain of what our roles and responsibilities are and what we'll get out of it. And if someone, for some reason, decides to step out and do something else, that we know how we can then manage that and ensure that they're not still making decisions when they have no day-to-day responsibility. So I think that was really, and you can put all of this into the shareholders' agreements, right? This is not something that you needs to be done on the side. It's part of what you're regulating as part of that agreement.
Well, absolutely. One of the things that I found really useful was good lever and bad lever provisions within a business, within the management team, within a business, which made very, very clear what each involved, and then make sure that somebody that may have come in early on and contributed an awful lot, but then moved on, still had some level of protection going forward. Because maybe the business may never have been where it was, but their path, for whatever reason, took a different turn, you know. On a personal level, before it wasn't a startup, it was an established business, I signed an agreement along with three colleagues to complete a management buyout, and 14 days later, sat in hospital, been told I had a very aggressive cancer, and it was inconceivable that I would return to work for at least 6 months. And thankfully, we had an agreement over and above the fact that those guys were brilliant, wonderful to me. Over and above that, they said, this is what we'll do under these circumstances. That was another really useful tool around that, which is simply a minimum agreement, which doesn't have to be incorporated within the shareholders' agreement, but it would allow you just to put in a legal context what you're agreeing. But of course, I think we've underscored this, but it means having good legal advice.
Yes, definitely. So what's number two then?
Number two is, this is not to be pessimistic, it's to be very realistic. And that's only 25% of companies succeed in the long term. So one must always be ready when setting up and launching a business for the reality that this may not last. This may not work out. It may not work out in the short term, which is probably the easiest one to deal with, but it may also not work out in the long, in the medium term, which is about limping forward and never quite getting to where you want to be, and never quite becoming the business you want to or need it to be. And the real successful people, I believe, are the ones when that scenario develops, are willing to say enough is enough, time to draw a line under where we are and move on to my next thing.
Yes, I think that's, I think we've discussed this before, right? Where you can go all the way and sell everything and keep the business going just because you want to keep the business going. So there's no fear of, there is a fear of failure, I guess. And so you shouldn't really fear failure. I guess the other question, I guess my other point here would be, would you be also saying that don't be afraid of taking risks?
Absolutely. Well, there's a very strong correlation between risk and return. The bigger the risk, the higher the return. So, you know, there's no harm in going for something that is out there if you understand the risk that you're taking, but also very much like what we're saying there, which is don't keep flogging it. If it's a big risk and you're not getting traction, maybe it was a risk too far. I think the other bit to point to make here is that virtually every successful entrepreneur has also failed before they became successful. And actually, many fail again after they've been successful. But the clever ones are the ones that take the learnings and move on and cut their losses when the losses are just becoming unsustainable or outwith their original expectation or will. Number three.
Hire a good accountant. So this was one of mine, and I think... I don't have to labour the point here, really, but make sure that you have someone on the finances side that can help you not only with all the payroll and bookkeeping pieces, but also understands your business and understands how can you be tax efficient? How can you get things like R&D credits? Because I know that I've talked to startups previously, and actually that R&D tax credits is a good example where I've said to them, okay, has your accountant told you how to structure your accounts so that you can take advantage of things like R&D tax credits? So when the time comes for you to be able to know what expenses were for R&D purposes and research purposes and for your product, that you can pull those out quickly and then send them to the HMRC. And striking, a lot of them don't, right? A lot of our accountants, either they do know or they know a little bit about R&D tax credits, but they're not setting up the business so that they can get these things when the time comes. And I think that's really important. I've been very lucky with my accountants, who's also a very good friend of mine, that he understands these things very well. And so, you know, you need to make sure that that person is there behind you. So you can also have some reassurance that there's someone on the out there who understands the money. And I think one of the key things that, well, the only other point to make here really is that, you know, when you talk, your accountant will have lots and lots of other clients, right? So you won't necessarily have the full time from that person. So make sure that whoever you've got a good rapport with, you can actually get time from them when you need to. But also that their other businesses aren't completely different from yours. So if you're the first tech company and that person has only ever dealt in property and commercial property, then you probably want to think again, right? Because they wouldn't have that experience in dealing with companies like this.
I think that's really great advice in terms of where appropriate having external accountant. My little anecdote on this was, I remember going and pitching and doing an investment raising pitch. And the chap in the room said, right, I get it. You know about sales to our chief exec, pointing to me, you're the strategy guy. I'm pointing to my colleague and said, you're the technology guy. Brilliant. I'm about to give you a lot of money. Who's going to look after my money? Because I don't want you lot running away. I want something that's keeping an eye on the numbers. And part of our clincher in that was we were able to, as part of the NDA, then reveal that we had a fourth partner, fourth person involved, who was a vastly experienced finance director, but he was only going to come on board once we were funded. That was a clincher there. So absolutely, keep an eye. Have somebody managing the money that actually knows how to manage the money. Mm. Number four for me, customers aren't loyal. This can be a real heartbreaker for people starting businesses. When you go out and you win some customer, some client, some contract, and they deliver a brilliant service, they do the best they can, and then when it comes up for renewal, it's not renewed. And that then leaves a great big hole in the business. If one accepts that customers aren't loyal at the beginning, and that in every relationship, customers come and customers go, and very seldom do they hang around for an extended period, then at least one can be psychologically ready to accept that this is always about new business.
Yes, I think just in our kind of story of Atom, we found that customers are loyal, but we don't depend on it. I think that's from our perspective. We know that okay, our customers stay with us for a while, but I'm always...
But how long? How long did they stay with you for?
Well, I mean, we've had 3 years for the longest one, and then the other one is... the second longest is probably about a year, year and a half now. So I think... But it's a slightly different
situation. If you're looking for a 5 or 10 year business, do you... You know, well, maybe they will. And this is my point. If they do, it's great. But actually, most customers, companies, churn through their supplier base. It is just a fact of life.
Definitely. I mean, the fact is that I never thought that they'd be around for 3 years in the sense that I wasn't I wasn't expecting them to leave, but I was also assuming that they'd build their own team and they'd do their own thing. But actually, our service is better than them doing themselves. I think that what I'm trying to say here is that every year I have them in the budget, but I always just assume that that will go away at some point in time.
And inevitably, you can never sit back and say, well, we're going to rely on that income, because unless it is contracted and it was contracted for a period, one must always plan around the fact that they won't be there at some point. And if I'm not continually replacing them and replenishing, then my business will start to fail.
Yes, and I think here, actually, one thing to reiterate in this is that they're only as loyal as your termination clause, right? So if there is on a 3 month termination clause, then you just got to expect that it's 3 months left.
I had an experience many years ago in the world of advertising where our biggest client was acquired and immediately, as a matter of course, terminated all contracts. And that was a negotiation ploy. But it meant that something that we'd worked on and done a great job for a very long time all of a sudden went right out of the business plan. So it's just really, if you understand that point that loyalty doesn't really exist and you have to earn it and retain it all the time. Number five for me, written is bold and underlined, business plan dramatically increases the likelihood of success. And I guess what this really means is one level behind that is if you've actually written down and committed to the plan, it's likely that in the act of writing it down and committing it to paper, you will have actually done your own due diligence. So often I hear of businesses that have got a bit of an idea and can talk forever. But is it actually well thought through? Is it actually planned out? The act of doing that is incredibly valuable.
No, I agree. I've seen plenty of startups that have great pitch decks, but then when you ask them, what's your go-to-market and when do you expect to be not even necessarily profitable, but had, what's your burn rate and all these kinds of things that they just don't have it. And I think without having a business plan that understands, okay, where's your money coming from? Where's your money going? That if things change and you face challenges, you're not quite sure where you won't really have any kind of idea of where you should be saving or what you can be, you know, what you can do to increase sales, etc. So, yeah.
I've been working with a corporate finance advisor recently on another early stage business that's looking to raise. And he drove home a point that I guess has been there all along, but he's a money man. And he said, so many businesses come to him and say, I need a business plan. And what they mean is, I need a financial plan. And his point of view on that is, I can do the numbers for you, that's no issue at all. But what's the story? What's the narrative? Because numbers without a narrative are just a pile of numbers. Mm. And you have no context to it. And I think sometimes people have a habit of trying to avoid that part because it makes them commit to, who will your customers be? How many products will you sell to them? Why would they buy from you? What are their other options? How will you develop your team? And articulating all of that. And as Mike was saying, the two things are absolutely hand in glove. One leads the other leads back.
I think this kind of pushes you neatly on to the next point, number six, right? Cash is king. So I was having a discussion the other day with someone, a completely different topic, right? So this is about property. And what he pointed out was, when people buy properties, they'll make decisions about cash, which are completely alien from the way they would normally think about money. So you were saying, for example, you know, you have a house that you bid £400,000 for, and then another offer will come in at £425,000, and you'll say, okay, yeah, let's just put in £450,000. And he said, it's a £50,000 increase, right?
Yeah.
Now, what other situation are you going to suddenly give away an extra £50,000? And a little bit is, you know, having a written business plan keeps you honest. So you know that I can't suddenly spend another 20,000-30,000. But then obviously understanding cash is king. Without cash, can't pay.
Well, and there's also the thing about cash flow.
Mm.
Now, it doesn't matter what the numbers look like. If when you have to settle an invoice, there's nothing in the bank account, it doesn't matter that you're going to be really, there's going to be a real profit come the end of the year. Because you won't see the end of the year. You know, which is why, for me, it was never really in the early stages a focus on profitability. It was a focus on cash flow. It was about making sure that we could live long enough to get into second gear. It was getting through that first gear.
Yes, and I think, again, you know, when we started Avrium, it was because cash is king. And I think the principles of what we started there are the same for all small businesses, right? Make sure you know who you're getting into business with. You make sure that you've got the payment terms set out that are right for your business. Make sure that you're chasing payments. Make sure actually that you're invoicing people, because this is one of the things. Even people who I know who are consulting for me, and I have to chase them to get an invoice raised. And I say, look, you know, which I find quite incredible, because I'm chasing, I know that I need to pay them, but for my own part, I need to know what my liabilities are, right? And yeah.
Well, there's that element around financial management. There's also another one on early stage, i.e. when you're just getting it up and running, which is around cash, which is sometimes there'll be opportunities that pop up that are maybe not part of your long-term plan, but would put an influx of liquid cash, i.e. pound notes or dollar bills, into your business. And that might be taking a week out to do a bit of consultancy elsewhere that will put some money in that will then allow you to move down the line. And there's no point in being precious, because when you look at the bank account and there's nothing there, it's really limited to how you can move forward. So on to number seven.
So rediscover old contacts. So this is something that I find interesting when I've set up businesses myself, is that obviously when you're working in for a larger company, or if you're working in a corporation, you'll be meeting people along the way that will be good for that day and time, right? But as you move on and as you start your own thing, it's always worth looking back over who you've met and seeing if any of those guys have moved on. And if they have, maybe they're doing something that's much more complementary to what you're doing now. And because you'll have met them, they'll have understood how you work and understand who you are and how you do things. They'll be much more friendly to you. And I think, you know, one of the things that's most daunting for people who are starting their new business is trying to go out and get sales. So they always think they have to go and convince new people that what they're doing is worthy, when actually they already know a whole bunch of people. They just don't know how those people can help them in this new context. And I think that's one of the key things is going back and saying, okay, I'm doing something new now. Who do I know or that I've met before that might be able to help me in any small way to move forward?
There's also, I mean, extending that into old contact and also new contact. I don't think there's ever been a time where there's been an environment more supportive of startup and entrepreneurship. It is now recognised widely that one of the greatest assets is support and a network and a context that will allow you to learn and develop. And will gladly offer help and support. And that doesn't have to mean an overwhelming amount of time and input. It might just be a mentor, somebody that you know or you've been introduced to. They will sit down once a month, have a coffee, have a chat, have a telephone call, have a Zoom, and might just keep you on that route through and be there in your time of need to help you move forward.
Yeah, I think one thing for any young listeners out there, someone told me this, I can't remember who told me this, or where I heard it from, but someone said that, you know, in your 20s, you build your skills, in your 30s, you build your networks, and in your 40s, you use the skills of the networks that you've built over the past 20 years. And I think that's very true.
Absolutely. And some of the most successful people I see in this area, their greatest asset, and actually this links on to number 8, things don't magically work out, is their ability to, one, find advice and then take that advice, which is about accelerating your skills and experience, particularly your experience. So the point I was highlighting here is nothing is a given. It won't happen unless you make it happen. Things don't just magically work out. And this really gets back to the fact that I know that the old saying is the harder I practice, the luckier I get. I think what I would extend that into is the harder I work, the luckier I get. There is an absolute correlation between putting in the yards and the likelihood of success. There's so many businesses that think stuff will just go right. You know, I'm amazed at the number of people who think that, well, there's investors out there. They give people like me money to go and find out if this will ever work or not. And I'm minded of a bit of advice that I got, which was the reason investors are typically very successful is that they're very good at only backing the good ideas. So they are not there to back everybody. They will scrutinize, they will reject 99 ideas before they find one that they're willing to put their money in.
Yes, and I think I'll come in with a slightly different angle to this, and that's internally as well, right? So I over the last few weeks, we've discussed that, you know, I've been working with my team on their own objectives, and I think one of the things that I've tried to get into their heads is that, you know, if you want to do something, you want to improve yourself, you can't just, it's not going to magically happen. You know, you need to do things. So, for example, you know, from a larger scale with a business, if you want to make more money, you can't just expect people to knock on your door. But even when you're looking at your own internal employees and the objectives that they've got, if they want to become, let's say, a better marketer, a better salesperson, that's not just going to happen just by thinking about it, right? There's things that you need to go and do and work on, and objectives you need to put forward, and then results that you need to meet to make that happen. And I think this is it. It's all about the hard graft, right?
So the harder they work, the more they train, the more they develop, the more they read, the more likely they will have the skills and experience or the contact. Because networking it is work. The more likely they'll be able to say, I know how to do this, or I know somebody can help me do this.
Definitely.
And number 9.
Understand your runway. So again, this kind of goes back to the cash is king and really actually number 2 as well, and number 5. So it all relates together. It's to understand, you know, what is your burn rate? And if you don't know what a burn rate is, go look it up. Understand how much money you have left, how much money you have left each month. So if nothing happened, if you didn't win any kind of new work, how much money you would be able, how long you would be able to survive. Because that's a really good indicator for how healthy your business is, right? And what you, where you need to focus your efforts on. Because once you've got your, once you understand your runway and how much you have left, in the bank over a period of time, you'll understand, okay, do I need to deal with costs or do I need to deal with revenue? Or what's my profitability? It's really getting to understand your money and knowing your numbers. And if you don't know your numbers and you're not on top of your cash flow, then inevitably number two will occur, that you'll fail. And I think this is the thing that a lot of people don't really get. And in this day and age of tech startups where everyone's expecting never to make a profit or, and to be constantly raising investment, you know, that's fairly irresponsible simply because you're not going to build an Uber. Not, you know, it's very, very unlikely that you're going to build a company that people are going to pump cash into indefinitely. So you need to understand how you're making your money and where the money's going.
I think that's a very good point, because these mega techs are not the reality of 999,999 startups. You know, one in a million becomes a mega tech. Most of these businesses are much more, whether you're in tech or whatever area they're in, just all of this applies whether you're starting a building company, a tech company, a services company, whatever it is, that the fundamentals apply in keeping that business going. And finally,
find your voice. So the reason I put this down is because it's quite a, it impacts many different areas, right? So when I say find your voice, it's not only how do you talk to your customers, right? How do you do sales? How do you do marketing? But it's find your voice when it's dealing with things like suppliers, right? What kind of customer do you want to be to your own suppliers? What kind of leader do you want to be for your own employees? You know, how do you want to present this business as a whole? So it's in a way finding your ethos. And why you're not only why you're doing the business, but how you want to treat people and how you want to be treated by others. It could well be that you want to play hardball with every single supplier that you've got. And that could be your thing. So don't then be surprised if people do the same things to you, right? But it's really about understanding your pathway and the way that you work within this business, because it's going to be a learning journey, right? No one's going to get this right first time, and you're going to need help along the way. And you need to be able to find out who you really are as a, not only as a person, but as a businessman and as a businesswoman, of course, or just generally, how you're dealing with everyone around you and all the different key stakeholders that you've got. And ultimately also with your own family, because, you know, you've got to decide from very early on how you want to balance your work and your life. And, that's all part of finding your voice.
Well, that's really important, because, in the strategy workshops that I do, I start them off not asking what people want for their business, but I ask them about what they want for them out of this. How will they know that they are succeeding? How will they know that they are getting what they want out of their business, out of their startup, out of their current business, or out of their evolved business? Because if they're not going to get the return that they want, whatever that is, and it's not always financial. A lot of people do it for love and passion, or maybe it's for social benefit. It doesn't have to be a big number at the end of the day. But that really drives back to, what are their values? What is it that they believe in? And once you understand that, that will also then allow you to look at the business that you're developing and say, I know what my values are. What's its values? What does it believe in? Where is the line that it will say, no, I won't? And a little example of that was a famous ad agency in Scotland that many years ago got into a bit of a debate around when it said that it would not run, it would not work with a cigarette company. And they said, Hypocrite. Your company runs alcohol ads, and alcohol is just as bad for you as smoking. And the CEO and the founder said, yes, but I drink, I don't smoke. So morally, I'm happy to support something I'm willing to do, but I'm not happy to support something I personally don't agree with. So that comes down to, you know, in my world of marketing, my background in marketing, We would have said, what are your brand values? What do you believe in? What's your personality? How do you act and how do you behave? And when you're clear on that, then that should guide everything you do.
Definitely, definitely. So it looks like, Alan, that we've kept to half an hour, which I'm very impressed.
That's a miracle.
I know. It's amazing, isn't it?
So there's 10 things that Maram and I would argue, you know, and 10 things is not the only 10 things. But if you bear these in mind, I firmly believe that you'll have a much greater chance of succeeding in business, but also creating the business that you actually want to have.
And I hope this has really made you think and provoked some internal dialogue that'll help you figure things out when you are launching your business. So good luck with everything.
As we move forward with the podcast, we're going to carry on introducing guests from time to time who can bring in a particular perspective on what they're doing. But we're also going to have a focus on these shorter sort of 30-minute podcasts, either on audio or on video, if you choose to watch us and not just listen to us, where we will aim to share little, I don't know if I use the word, but masterclass type ideas, things that we've learned that are hard, practical advice that will help people starting businesses and running businesses. So thanks for joining us today. It's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.
Bye for now.
Cheers.